Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, December 20th, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As we near the end of the Anglo-Dutch controlled Cheney Bush administration, we have to confront two problems. And by we, I mean those of us in the LaRouche movement and those of us who are committed to the constitutional republic of the United States of America. The first of these problems is the deliberate effort by the British Empire, working through Treasury Secretary Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke, to leave to the incoming Obama administration a hopelessly collapsed financial system in which sovereign nation states are destroyed, and the only alternative appears to be accepting a global Shaktian system of fascist austerity. The second problem is that any nation which acts to resist this outcome will be subjected to the kind of asymmetric warfare, sometimes called terrorism, such as that which was unleashed against Mumbai, India at the end of October. Within days after that attack, Lyndon LaRouche and his wife Helga and the EIR's Jeffrey Steinberg went to India for a series of public and private meetings, during which Mr. LaRouche discussed why he says it's the forces of the British Empire which are behind both problems, and why he's optimistic that India, through its involvement in a four-power agreement with Russia, China, and the United States, can play a leading role in defeating those Anglo-Dutch oligarchic forces. With us on the LaRouche Show today to talk about this trip and its profound strategic implication is Rantanu Maitra, the New Delhi correspondent of Executive Intelligence Review, who just got back from India. And we will also be joined by LaRouche Youth Movement members Michael Steger from Los Angeles and Alicia Charitani from the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room. So, Tanu, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Hardy.
Why don't we begin with a summary of the significance of the LaRouche trip to India? Why was this such an important event?
Well, Mr. LaRouche went in, first time he went to India was in, well, that was before India became an independent nation. But it's during Mrs. Gandhi's, Mrs. Indira Gandhi's regime in 82 and then in 83. In 83 itself, he was addressing this question of the distortion of the Bretton Woods system, which will lead to the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. And he suggested to Mrs. Gandhi at the time is that India should push forward at least a discussion on a new Bretton Woods system, which is, he really laid out a lot of details of that. On the basis of that, Mrs. Gandhi sent out, as far as I know, more than 150 letters to various heads of state concerning this, the concern that Mr. LaRouche had expressed about the collapse of the, imminent collapse of the financial system. One of her cousins told me that less than 50%, 30% answered that letter. But nonetheless, India was always very aware that the distortions that have been caused by this financial system will prevent India from moving forward in doing what is necessary in order to keep the population growing and alleviate some of the poverty, the massive poverty that exists. This was more so during Mrs. Gandhi's time, and then later they went into the fell into the trap of this globalization. I am not so much as IMF, but globalization in adopting more or less the Chinese model, which is basically export-oriented model. India, of course, didn't go that far.
But Tanu, let me just to clarify this, because a lot of our listeners are under the wrong belief that India actually has been growing as a as an industrial economy in due to globalization. So how do you answer that?
Well, basically what India has really not grown because of globalization. What has happened is that India always had India had a domestic economy which was much bigger than Chinese domestic economy as late as 1990s. What India really required at that point in time was that India didn't have any export capability, and without export capability, with the kind of financial system that you have, you do not have any import capability either. So therefore, the importation of technology, importation of high-tech stuff for India became very difficult until unless they have to they generate a foreign exchange. It is, you know, it is not a raw material exporting nation, hence it didn't have the capability to generate foreign exchange. So what came about in the late 1990s with this information technology business that came out is that the Indians, you know, picked on this information technology, picked up this information technology thing quickly, and became a major source of earning of foreign exchange reserves, a foreign exchange from mostly from Europe and United States. However, the foreign exchange that was generated was not utilized to build up the infrastructure, which is absolutely necessary in order to deal with the massive poverty that exists. So the infrastructure was not built. What happens in a situation like that, which the administration came to realize much later, they should have realized it faster, is that the people who bring in this foreign exchange, their demand for investment in that area becomes much more, they become much more vocal than getting the money into the other necessary areas. So this is what happened. Globalization allowed India to generate a certain amount of foreign exchange reserves and dollar reserves and all that. It also became the other thing is that there was a phony foreign exchange reserve built up in India, which is parking the money away from for better return from Indian stock market. The money were parked in large amounts, hundreds of billions of dollars, and then that could vanish within a minute or seconds. But India was under the Indian authorities were giving the impression that India has now built up a huge foreign exchange reserve thanks to globalization. And this large foreign exchange reserve will be able to meet the demands for importation of technologies and building up of infrastructure. However, they did nothing in either direction. Long before it was done, the financial system gave in. So I think that's how I saw it.
Well, so the crisis then would be that there's a phony sense of security that India might be able to weather the global financial crisis?
There is an element of that exists. The only thing good about the only thing real about that that feeling is that India still has the banking system is nationalized, so it's national banks. Secondly, the insurance, the companies, there are some insurance companies have been allowed in, but that is less than 20 to 25% of the insurance. Main insurance company, Life Insurance Corporation, and other insurance corporations are government.
So then even before let's assume there had not been terrorism in Mumbai, there were people who were interested in what Mr. LaRouche said because of this history of his role with India, with Indian government officials, and people who are aware that this is not a secure financial situation. Is that basically is that accurate?
Yes, that's accurate. And there is also a realization that now that the globalization we have accepted, our dependency on earning foreign exchange reserves is based upon this globalization system that exists. Now, all these are gone, so we'll be again facing a situation in which we'll not have foreign exchange reserves and we'll be we have to be inward looking, and that will not help us at all to alleviate the poverty that exists and build the infrastructure. So there is a huge crisis exists within, and they do not have the answer how to deal with this, particularly since it is evident that these phony dollars that came in or phony euros that came in were vanishing, because here the banks, the money is evaporating, so all the money, real money, is being pulled back. So that was also a crisis, and that crisis was very often, I think, throughout the trip. In this trip, Mr. LaRouche addressed, I think, five different seminars or workshops and all that.
Well, now then, to make the whole trip much more strategically significant, a few days before Mr. LaRouche left, there was this major terrorist initiative in Mumbai.
Right.
And this became obviously a focal point of what Mr. LaRouche was saying.
Yes. But interestingly enough, that in the first three presentations on 3rd of December, 4th of December, and 5th of December, it was always the how we deal with this financial collapse. Since you are the person who had been talking about this, and since you are the person who had warned us about this, you must explain to us how to go about and deal with it. That was always the first item in the agenda. And then, through mostly with question and answer time, and in minor presentation by other speakers, the question was what to do with this terrorism that happened in Mumbai,
right.
How to deal with this thing, where it is coming from, and all that kind of stuff.
And so in this sense, Lin is very well known, Mr. LaRouche is very well known among the political and intelligence elites of India,
right,
as an economic forecaster.
Right. Absolutely true.
And there's a – now, how do people there respond when Mr. LaRouche says India is one of the four powers? I mean, on the one hand, you might have a certain sense of satisfaction
for
that. On the other hand, it's a pretty awesome responsibility, given that he's saying that forget Europe, forget the other so-called powers, Japan. It's India is one of the four powers that can pull this together. How do people respond to that?
Well, the response, of course, there is this enormous satisfaction that there is somebody from the United States, a senior politician, is coming in and saying what we had been trying to say for years and years, and nobody was paying any attention. So that part of it is that, you know, sort of is massaging the ego or whatever you can call it. But
we know Lin isn't interested in doing that.
Yeah, no, he's not. But the second thing that was very much in their mind was that there are a number of things that India, of course, India, just because, you know, as Mr. LaRouche laid it out before them, that India's population, India's culture background, India's two basic things that India did, three basic things that India did, why India, he recognizes India has to be a major nation in the new international credit union, four-nation credit union that he was proposing. These three are India's Green Revolution. India took care of the agriculture, this massive population's food requirements. So India sought and achieved food security.
And that's a real Green Revolution,
that's
as
a real
opposed to the so-called environmental
The second thing was that at a very early stage, when India was, you know, almost just, you know, only 10 years after India became a republic, Nehru, despite all the poverty that existed, said that we must have an independent nuclear program. And nuclear power at that time, and India's nuclear installation, Bhabha Atomic Research Center, was set up in 1958-59, which is first among the developing nations, no doubt about that. Then also, simultaneously, I think within a year or two, he set up the space program, which was... Mr. LaRouche says that these three things that India did at a very early stage, when India was still struggling with, living from hand-to-mouth kind of situation, and sort of shaking off the colonial yoke, India looked forward that this should be the this is the right choices were made, and this right choices were made because there was a sort of a vision which no other developing nation had at that point in time. So India recognized that it has to take place in the front line of the all the nations, and they made these decisions at that point in time, and this makes it a very unique nation, and its population and its small but very highly qualified, you know, individuals, and its capability to assimilate, you know, various culture, because it's sort of on the, you know, on the threshold of Western nations and Eastern nations, and all have come through India. It's sort of a very another kind of cultural melting pot that India is. So
let me just take a moment to remind people they're listening to the LaRouche Show. We're hearing from Tanu Maitra, who is the Delhi desk of the Executive Intelligence Review, and someone who has a background. I believe you have a nuclear engineering background.
I have.
Yes. So he's. When he talks about nuclear power development, he's talking about it from having studied it and worked on it, and a longtime associate of Lyndon LaRouche. Now, Tana, we're going to bring on the LaRouche Youth Movement panel in just a moment, but there are two questions that came up to me from what you just said, this question of the three reasons why India should be included, and they're very interesting. First, I just wanted to know, I assume that those three points you identified were also reasons why India was a leader in the non-aligned movement in the 1950s.
Yes, absolutely so. No question about that. India has also had another, you know, a non-aligned movement. One of the leadership also came about because of the Indian leader at the time was Nehru. Nehru's particular interest in trying to convince the African leaders, not so much as Asian, African leaders to go all out for independence, colonial independence, independence from this colonial nation. So he was very well recognized in Africa as a leader, and all the African nations other than South Africa at that point in time were part of the non-aligned movement. So that was one of the things that Nehru took a position that this colonial yoke has to be shaken off, and every African nation should, you know, make an effort in that direction. So that was another thing. But
okay, now, given that and the importance of India coming out of World War II, having a revolution to overthrow British colonialism, and having this sense that getting rid of the colonial power opens your nation up for enormous potentials in scientific and technological development, does this view still exist among the political leadership in India, and to what extent was this something that, that Mr. LaRouche was able to rekindle among these people?
Yeah, unfortunately, the visions that Nehru or Mrs. Gandhi or even Rajiv Gandhi and later Prime Minister Rao had, that thing doesn't exist so much. What exists today is that, you know, there's a enormous amount of confusion and delusion at the same time, that it is through the globalization we'll be able to generate enormous amount of money, and that money would be then used for infrastructure development to make this country a major nation. In the areas of nuclear and space, I think that it has taken off very well. But in the area of nuclear, the thing doesn't exist much. Food, in the last, if you look at the last 10 years or 9 years of India's different sectoral growth, you will find that in certain sectors, some of them are manufacturing, some of them are service sector like IT and all that. The growth rate was 9-10, but over the 9 years, agricultural growth rate was less than 1.5. So there is a deliberate shortchanging of the agricultural sector, which is the key for India's survival. And the reason that India has remained in one piece, in my view, is because this food security and the agricultural sector was taken care of in the 1970s and 80s.
But this belief in globalization must be under assault given the collapse of the global financial system.
Yes, there's no question that there is no support for that any longer. Now there is, they are now crying uncle, and what to do? What to do now? This leadership hasn't shown the courage to, at least at G20 meeting in Washington in mid-November, didn't show the courage to spell out exactly what they want. They sort of went along, although they didn't commit themselves fully. They sort of went along with what Gordon Brown and all this crowd were saying about maintaining this Anglo-Dutch liberal financial system intact by putting in a strong monitoring system through IMF or something like that. That's where they were. They didn't have the courage to say, no, this system doesn't work, and we didn't need a new system. So when Mr. LaRouche went and talked to the military and the academics, economists, politicians, and all that, their thing is that this is correct. This is what you are saying is correct. But this cannot be done by us, because look at our leadership. They are incapable of doing that. So you have to move it from U.S. Mm-hmm. The thing has to move from U.S. And one thing we can assure you, that if U.S. moves this thing, then China and India can sit on the table. If India tries to move it, China will not sit. If China tries to move it, India will not sit. So when U.S. moves things and you give the push, then India, China will sit together. We don't know about Russia, because Russia has other problems with U.S., but mm-hmm. India, China will sit.
Well, this is quite interesting. I want to tell our listeners that our computer system is down. It's not my fault this time. My computer system's working fine, but the LaRusso computer system is down. But if you do have a question for Tanu, you can send an email question, and he agreed that he would answer them. So you can send it to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com, and put attention Tanu, TANU, and he will get them and he'll answer them. I also just want to mention that you can go to LaRouche Pack or LaRouche Pub and find very significant coverage of Lyndon LaRouche and Helga LaRouche and Jeff Steinberg's visit to India. There are articles up on the LaRouche Pub site. There are a series of releases, including the speeches, that are also available between that and the LaRouche Pack site. And as you can tell from just this little snippet we've had so far from Tanu, this was extremely significant. And Tanu, I want to ask one more question on this before I bring in Alicia and Michael, which occurs to me. One of the things Lynn said after coming back was that the British decision to launch the attack in Mumbai was one which had enormous backfire potential. That is, that it seems to me from what you're saying that the Indians were somewhat in a go-along-to-get-along mode. Why would you take the risk, if you're the British, and stirring them up by launching something like this? Do people in India get the point that Mr. LaRouche made, that this is a Saudi-British operation?
I think there's a lack of understanding in that direction. I mean, there are reasons for it. One of the reasons, of course, is that the general, what has happened over the Cold War period is that the left liberal, the British liberal crowd that existed in India, India, of course, was under the British rule for 190 years, and India had, its upper middle class and the wealthier class went to England for education, so they are sort of very Anglophile in that way. Perhaps, and beyond that, when the British had left in 1947, they kept 545 princely states which were not under the British rule. They paid Britain the tax and this and that and that, but they were not under the British rule. They had maintained a sort of a phony facade of independent rule, and they were princely states. And, because of the royal connection between London and these princely states, all these princely state, the feudal lords, were always very close to England. That's the only place they knew where they can go. So there is always a very strong British crowd exist within India. So they feel it very, and so during the Cold War period, they used to attack the Anglo-Americans, but what they really meant was Americans. You know, they were very strongly anti-American, they became, and there are other reasons behind that because of, you know, the politics that was going on in the subcontinent. So the British-Saudi thing is not being understood. Saudi thing is being understood, but is kept sotto voce because we have 160 million Muslims, and out of 160 million, about 145 are Sunnis, and they get enormous amount of financial support from Saudi Arabia and all that kind of thing. Not that for their living, but for their religious activities and all.
Well, with the people that Mr. LaRouche met with, including military and intelligence, they must have some indication, though, some idea that there is a guiding hand above this.
Oh, there is a clear understanding that Britain has consistently tried to break up the country. I mean, they broke it up in 1947 to make India, Pakistan two countries. Then Kashmir is a completely British-run operation. Then in 1980s, Khalistan operation in Punjab is a violent movement for independent state of Punjab within India. That was run from London. They're aware of it. But, you know, how this thing works, how the Saudi-British nexus, because general reading is in India is that Saudi Arabia is basically a lapdog of United States. United mm-hmm. States, you know, kind of, you know, has kept Saudi Arabia as its friend and Iran as its enemy, the Shia Sunni stuff. But the Saudi-British thing that too is became, we exposed it through this BAE stuff, yeah. Is sinking in. And when they're looking into it, these people, of course, who came to listen to Mr. LaRouche and they questioned Mr. LaRouche are fully aware of that. And yeah. they are still looking for a handle, how to deal with this thing.
Well, how about this? I think we have on the site today, Lyndon LaRouche's comments on Viktor Ivanov, mm-hmm. the federal anti-narcotics director from Russia, who singled out the Afghan heroin trade and also the role of the organized crime boss Dawood Ibrahim. And I think what he said is that this actually is, Mr. LaRouche said, this is the right way to look at it. Do you have any reading on the Indian response to Ivanov's intervention?
As of now, all I know is that Ivanov's pointing a finger at Dawood Ibrahim has been accepted as the right direction, because I also got a note last night from one of my friends saying that this is absolutely right. However, I think the in-depth understanding of how this thing works is not very clear to them, because in all our discussions during these 10 or 12 days of Mr. LaRouche's stay and his various interaction with almost and all level of Indians, one thing that always missing in this discussion was the effect of this 8,000 tons of opium that is being produced in mm-hmm. Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And its role in the terrorism that exists internationally, and who runs it, how it is run, and all that kind of thing, and what is its effect on overall stability of the world. This thing was missing. The general reading is that drug is run for making money, and money, then that's where it gets lost. After the money is being made, these are all illegal money. So how this money is being... So,
you know, you would think that someone would go back in Indian history and look at the Opium War and
yes.
get a clue, huh?
Yes. I wish they did.
Well, let me bring in our two LaRouche Youth Movement panel members who I'm sure have been quite fascinated by this discussion so far. Alicia is working in the War Room, where we've been putting out the breakthrough series of videos. And Alicia, if you went on the website, you can see her and a couple of them on national banking. We just had one that went up yesterday on the importance of Mr. LaRouche's visit to India and Strasbourg. How are we taking these absolutely important strategic interventions by Lynn and getting them out to the American people? What's the work product plan coming out of Purcellville, Alicia?
Well, we have, with the directive of LaRouche, we've got to think very carefully what the dynamic is now that there's an outgoing Bush administration and an incoming Obama administration. And the Obama administration is the best when they're reading our website and when they're listening to LaRouche. So what is in the back of our mind is that you have a group of high-level officials inside the United States and also outside the United States waiting to see what LaRouche says on any given event and any given hour of the day. But you also have a population who, as the financial collapse ensues, as a terrorist incidents or threats of assassinations ensue, and there's fewer and fewer answers to what's actually going on, they're also turning to the LPAC website to say, well, what does LaRouche know who's called this thing? What is his perspective on this thing? And so we start from the standpoint that there are people who want to do something about the crisis on the planet right now, but we have to be very clear about the historical development as this thing came from, you know, even 100 years, 200 years ago, what's actually developed so far. So the latest medium that we're using is the video product. And this comes from a fundamental understanding that LaRouche has very clear in his mind about how the human mind actually understands ideas. Because we're not just giving people news snippets. We're not just going to give people pieces. We want to develop a whole idea in someone's mind, because it's really only from there that people will be able to do something about what's going on around them in their lifetime, is that they get the historical idea of where they are right now. And so we're using the video product, this paradox between sight and sound. You take the paradox between these two, you see how the mind treats them, and that's where an idea is born. And it's very interesting because you never just have an economist. LaRouche isn't just an economist or a historian. All the economics, history, politics, all of these things come together. And so there's a real challenge to pose as a whole what are coming out in the regular news media as just events. And the question of Lynn's trip to India and some of the things that Tana was raising about the narco-terrorism and the British Empire is an excellent example of how all of these things sort of intersect and sort of expose themselves as one system. So that's our task, is just presenting this to people, to inquiring minds, what's actually happening, what's actually developing, what they're seeing.
All right. Well, and I know that the one that we put up, I think we put one up on George Soros. How do we get across? I know you're struggling with this there, and we're also thinking about this in the field. One of the key operatives of this Anglo-Dutch system is George Soros. And as Tanu was mentioning, the drug question, you know, here's Soros going for global drug decriminalization, drug legalization. His whole operation is based on these offshore money laundering capabilities. And at the same time, he tried to buy a U.S. administration by creating the means for the Obama administration to come into power. Now we have something interesting, which is that Soros looks as though he might be getting left on the outside. So I know we had an initial story on that from Leandra up on the website. What else is planned to get across to people why it is that the enemy of this country is not abstract British financial interests, but individuals such as George Soros?
Well, late last night or early this morning, there was an interview by the LPAC spokeswoman, Deborah Freeman, that we did yesterday in Baltimore. We posted that up, and it's not the entire interview, but there's pieces there that sort of nail George Soros up against the wall as a key part, as where the dope ink, as we refer to it, the drug trade and the terrorism and the institutions inside the United States all intersect.
And so that's up on the website now?
Yeah, that's up on the website right now. It's called The Nature of Dope Ink.
Wow, and you guys found Debbie, huh?
Uh-huh, we sure did.
Boy, that's really amazing.
I know.
We're really getting some good intelligence in there now.
Like I said, this is all under Lynn's directive, so these are Lynn's orders. And so this, the key thing is just to take George Soros, expose him for what he is, sort of break down some of the lines. It's useful if you watch what we put up there on Debbie. George Soros, he is behind this line you'll hear coming out about decriminalization, harm mm-hmm. reduction, and there's this real liberal bleeding heart line. Well, look, you know, we're filling all of our prisons with these teenagers who are dealing drugs. We can't do that. They'll get off to a wrong start, et cetera. The point that Debbie makes, which is really good, which is very, very good, is that, you know, since when does George Soros care about high schoolers going to jail? The guy's a Nazi. He takes pride in his history of working with Adolf Hitler. This is a complete farce. It's a line that he's feeding to the Democratic Party to make sure that they have some sort of opposition to a potentially good administration who would crack down on the use of drugs, which would be at least a foot in the door to go after the larger apparatus. So just really got to call George Soros out for what he is. He's lying to people, and his true career is what we're sort of exposing on LPAC.
Right. Tanu, is George Soros known among leaders in India?
Yes, in the strategic community, they have noticed the extensive operation of Open Society Foundation in Central Asia, where the drug is, you know, in the Fergana Valley. Then his connection with Saakashvili and the drug that is being run all the way to Russia to undermine Russian Federation. So Soros says that part of the role is known. And then, of course, you know, Soros-supported group, a British group called the Senlis Council, exists, which for last, I think, beginning in 2005, had started putting out these, holding this enormous number of seminars all over Europe and even in Afghanistan, saying that the only way to deal with the Afghan drug is to legalize cultivation of poppies. And in fact, you know, in reality, Karzai said that they are this organization, the Senlis Council, which is Soros' organization, is basically encouraging drug growing, should not have any office in Afghanistan. They're kicked out of Afghanistan, but nonetheless, it's still, you know, I think in month of October, they held a conference in Kabul. So these are, you know, they are aware of these things. But the downstream side of this drug, other than addiction and illegal money generation, all that, and how it supports the terrorism, how it supports various other nefarious activities in the world, and including various terrorist organizations who are fighting for independence and all that kind of thing, is not being fully understood. Mm-hmm. It is. What is also not understood is that how Soros could get to a position whereby he could influence the presidential election in the United States. I mean, this is, you know, completely beyond them. They just said, how could this guy in a country which is, you know, quite wealthy and has got 350 million people, how this one person could have such an influence? These are very difficult things for them to understand from that distance.
Well, I think one of the starting points for that is that he and his friends put up about $100 million to create the boots-on-the-ground operations, such as MoveOn.org, the blogosphere, and they created, using the anger at the Iraq War in the United States, they created this idea that you've got to go outside of Washington, outside of the Clintons in particular, and away from the old New Deal tendencies in the Democratic Party for something new.
Right.
And that's how they promoted Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And now that Obama was the beneficiary of all that Soros money and corruption in the Democratic Party, as the incoming president-elect, he's taking a look at what he's facing, and it appears as though he's closing the door to Soros
mm-hmm.
and actually opening the door to the Clinton networks that the Soros people wanted to keep out. So it's a very interesting situation. I'd like to bring Michael in now, because Michael's out on the ground in California, where we have the largest daily deployment of LaRouche Youth Movement members deploying into a situation where, on the one hand, you've got the Hollywood fantasy life, you've got the craziness of the belief in living in paradise. At the same point, we've got a fascist governor, the collapse of the state. Soros funded an initiative on the ballot in California. He's very close with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Michael, are these questions now of economic reality and depression and terrorism, are they getting through to at least some of the young people?
Oh, I lost your last part of your question there, Harley. Can you say it again?
I was just asking if the reality is getting through to young people that we're organizing in California.
Oh, yeah, I think so. There's a couple of things that have been happening which indicate a kind of a shift taking place here, which I'm sure is indicative for the country. We had recently had a town hall meeting here in the port of Long Beach, Los Angeles, which is a key center for trade for the United States and really internationally. It's kind of the center of the import economy of the United States today. And we had over 100 people attending, really based on a broad-based mobilization to the Longshoremen's Union, to people that live in the port area and the general area of Los Angeles. And in terms of an attendance to our meetings, this is extremely high. There was no special attendance of special guests, no senators or congressmen. It was straight. It was a straight town hall meeting to discuss the economic crisis, and the authority was LaRouche and LaRouche PAC. We had a broad-based attendance, and many people stayed afterwards. And the ones who stayed afterwards were the population we're recognizing to be more and more now politically active in the kind of in the tradition of what the American system represents. It's people who are young adults, 25 to 35-year-old adults, who realize the economic system has collapsed and are open and have heard some of these conspiracy lines of the British or, you know, the Bilderbergers or whatever groups, the Trilateral Commission, but are looking for a larger question of for what reason would the conspiracies exist? If there is such a conspiracy to destroy the U.S. Constitution, and what they're gravitating towards LaRouche PAC and towards our website is because of an idea content, the basement work, the science work, the Kepler, a sense of real ideas and a sense of creativity. And it was funny, we had one young man who attended a weekend seminar we had about a month ago who was very interested by the ideas and the discussion and saw the kind of the no future condition of today's educational system. And but he had become a little bit withdrawn and wasn't sure why. He wasn't coming around as much. And so I had contacted him after the Mumbai bombings and terrorist attack and LaRouche's visit. And he had actually said that one of the things that he thought was a little strange about what we were doing was our emphasis on the insidious nature of the British Empire and how this was really, if you're going to understand the current political situation, you'd have to understand the role of the British Empire and people like George Soros from that standpoint. That he wasn't so sure of. But after the Mumbai bombings, he reported that a number of people he discussed with who were involved in somewhat in political discussions were all referencing the British Empire and the British involvement in the Mumbai attacks. And so a big light went on in his head and said, I think this guy LaRouche has got a point. So I think there's a broad-based discussion happening. I think a lot of the youth are beginning to respond to some of these larger global strategic questions. And so it's been a lot of fun organizing.
Well, I think the other thing I would be interested in from you is on specifically this question of the four powers, because, you know, the Port of Los Angeles, the state of California, is supposed to have an orientation toward the east. We just saw in the last days very significant coverage of LaRouche in Chinese press, and I think also there was some coverage from his trip, although I'll ask Tanu in a minute, but Do you think people in California have a sense that if you look at it, we're talking about a move toward the Pacific with the Eurasian land bridge, the Trans-Siberian railroad, the Bering Straits tunnel, trade to potential massive infrastructure trade with China, India. Does that register, or do you find most youth still somewhat clueless on these kinds of broader strategic questions?
Well, the youth, as we have kind of traditionally referenced them, of maybe an 18 to 25-year-old college-age bracket, they tend to be more and more culturally and deprived. It's largely a real aggressive attack from the video game culture, which is somewhat of another topic. But the youth within the campuses today are responsive to seeing the kind of political mobilization of other parts of the population, specifically this somewhat older generation. And so we are getting youth involved in this larger strategic question. The Four Powers Agreement, I think, has everybody very excited, especially out here on the West Coast, because they can see the potential in terms of not only a reference towards Asia, but there's also a real sense here, especially in Los Angeles, around the questions of Mexico and South America. Mm-hmm. And so in bringing in that entire picture of an economic orientation for the world stemming from places like Los Angeles towards China, towards Russia, towards India, and then towards Mexico and the rest of South America, I think there's a real significant economic potential. And I think part of our responsibility here with LaRouche PAC is to kind of catalyze more of a discussion around that idea and make that a driving point for the next administration.
And then that opens up people to actually thinking about real culture, because that's how you generate cultural optimism.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, Tanu, on this question, if you, just having come back from India, would you say that the aftermath of the bombings, the terror attacks in Mumbai, have made people there more open to the kind of discussion that Mr. LaRouche is talking about, or turning inward? Did the terrorism work to stir up chauvinistic reactions against Pakistan? I mean, how do you see things unfolding in the next months in India?
Well, I think that the chauvinistic thing will not show through. I think that one of the purpose of this attack in my book is that the British were taking the help of this massive terrorist organizations that have been built up with the help of the dope money and all that. It was trying to create the attack will create an enormous amount of Hindu fanatic uprise against the Muslims. And Britain has come to realize now that India cannot be divided any longer. India, the breakup India is not possible, but attacks like this eventually will lead to attacks like this coming from Pakistan or any other Islamic nation will eventually lead to a rise of the Hindu fanaticism within India. There are seeds of that exist. It's not that it doesn't, it does. And these Hindu fanatics, and then India will be, there will be an invisible partition happening within India in which 160 million Muslims will be confronted constantly by this 850 million Hindus or whatever.
So you'd have an internal clash of civilization.
Internal clash, and there'll be no cooperation. So all the potential for India to go forward and all the basic groundwork that has been done, the three things that Mr. LaRouche pointed out, the nuclear independence, food independence, and the space program. And the benefits of these will not materialize, so India will remain a struggling, poor nation. Now, one of the things that has to be kept in mind that the British are looking at this time that this Anglo-Dutch financial system has collapsed, and people like LaRouche, and some of it is also reality, will force world to develop a system which will bring to focus, bring in these large nations, United States, Russia, China, India, maybe Japan, Brazil, and all that. But when these big countries sit down and on the table and discuss the financial system, the new financial system or the credit union, as Mr. LaRouche pointed out, there will be other things will be put on the table. For example, India will immediately put on the table that the entire United Nations has to be redone, and in this, these large nations will be the major players. And then India will immediately come in and said that the India is a nuclear weapon state and therefore should be recognized as a nuclear weapon state. India doesn't recognize nuclear non-proliferation treaty because it's biased and prejudiced. So therefore, the entire NPT to be scrapped. A new NPT. So all these kind of things that they had built up, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, over the last 40 years, and 60 years following Roosevelt's death, will go down the drain. So it is not only one thing, it's everything.
So, but for humanity, those would be good developments.
Those are the good developments, exactly right.
These things were put in place precisely to limit the potential of the Roosevelt Bretton Woods policy.
Exactly. And so this is why this attack is, there will be more attacks if these things, that's what I conveyed to my Indian friends and people who matter, that if this thing is not adequately investigated with the correct focus that this is an attempt to create a crisis within India, Pakistan has no business in doing it. Pakistan has its own crisis three times as much. So if this thing is not investigated properly, attack like that will happen again and again and again. And only way to get rid of this kind of attack is to investigate correctly and point the finger at the right parties. So that's what is, I hope that it will work out that way. But
And that's what Lyndon LaRouche put out in the statement on that's up on the website on the Ivanov intervention. He basically said that we're getting feedback that these are new forms of post 9/11 terror, that these are set to go in any city anywhere in the world. And if you want to stop it, you have to shut down these British-run narco-terror networks. We have about 8 minutes to go, and I'd like to see if Alicia or Michael have any questions for Tanu, either of you, Alicia, you have anything you want to bring up?
Let me see if Mike has anything.
Michael?
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. One is regarding, I thought it was somewhat coincidental that you had the president of Russia visiting India around the same time LaRouche was in discussions around the nuclear power cycle and these types of things. And so maybe you could maybe comment on that a little bit. And the other thing was, in some of your comments, which I think were very provocative, was a sense of India as somewhat of a Eurasian culture itself, somewhat of a melting pot. Maybe discuss maybe some of the, as LaRouche sometimes references it, this idea of a language culture, to maybe provide some more insight into India's way of thinking for most of us.
Good. So first on this Russian-Indian agreement on nuclear energy, what's new there?
Since this nuclear suppliers group, NSG, as a part of the U.S.-India nuclear deal, NSG approved supply of nuclear-related material, including nuclear reactors, to India. The door has opened up for any other nation to supply nuclear reactors with fuel and all that. So, of course, the Russians had supplied India four nuclear reactors before, 1,000 megawatt each, and they are now in the process of getting installed. Indians were, of course, they're looking for four more in the same place. So it is an 8,000 megawatt complex that they want to build. Russians, the moment this opened up, they said that they will be willing to provide these four nuclear reactors. And Medvedev, I think at the earliest opportunity, came in to seal the deal. And actually, the deal was done before. Only the signing was done during Medvedev's visit.
But this is something that the United States could be involved in if we had this four-power agreement, right? I mean, there's a tremendous need for infrastructure development that can't be simply provided for from within India.
Yes, it can be, but, you know, the unfortunate part of the nuclear power is that there is because the nuclear power was shut down over the last 30 years, there is only one foundry, Japan Steel Foundry, which manufactures Calandria. That is the main nuclear reactor vessel. And the Japan Steel Foundry has only the capability to manufacture only 4 to 5 Calandria a year. So if we consider the entire world's requirement of nuclear reactors, and if West, and that includes U.S., France, whoever else, and Japan, supply nuclear reactors to any nation, Japan Steel Foundry is the only one who can build Calandria. Now, I think, already Areva has signed up with Westinghouse to build Calandria in Alabama, and then Areva has gone to India to sign a deal with India's Larsen & Toubro to build Calandria over there. So now
this sort of goes beyond the scope of our program, but
yes.
It's clear that this is something that Lynn has talked about in terms of gearing up and rebuilding
yes,
the
yes.
machine tool sector in the United States for precisely this kind of project.
Right.
On the second question from Michael, the cultural question, I mean, briefly, what is there then within India that has allowed this kind of melting pot, and what are the implications for this, for the potential for a post or a new Westphalian order?
Well, I think that India had been historically, you know, India, through the Khyber Pass, enormous number of invaders have come to India, and they have all settled down in India. They never went back, other than the Brits. Nobody went back. They settled over there. And so we have a enormous mixture of culture between Turkey, Iran, Central Asia, and of course, China. The Chinese never invaded, but they trickled in because of their embracing of Buddhism, which is, you know, India is the center of it. There is a huge number of nations in the surrounding areas where the Indians went over, entire Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, and all that area. And then people from the West came in and settled inside India. And the mixture of culture took place in a very big way. So that's why the India is always considered as a threshold to West and East. In fact, if we ask a chauvinist Chinese, he will tell you that India is Western nation, is not an Eastern nation. India is not a part of Asia. India is part of Europe. That kind of stuff they will say. But in fact, in reality, this is what happened, that it is in the threshold of, you know, it's a gateway to West, it's a gateway to East, because this is where most of the cultural stuff got mixed, particularly in the northern part of India.
Well, I think that was also one of the reasons why it was so central for the maintenance of the British Empire then.
That's right. Absolutely right.
It was at a strategic crossroads both on land and
yes.
by sea.
Yes, and also the access to Russia and access to Arabia all emanates from India.
And some other time, I'd like to talk to you about the battle between the Arab Bureau in Cairo and the British Office High Command in India, which... That was the center of the battle over who would control the Arabian world after the collapse of the Turkish Empire.
Right.
Well, this has been a most interesting hour. Time always goes fast on this. Let me again offer to our listeners, since we couldn't take your email questions today, if you have questions for Tanu, send them to radio@larouchepub.com. Attention, Tanu. And he will answer them. Also, it's early to begin mentioning this, but January 22nd will be the next webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. And we have a lot of work to do between now and the incoming administration, the inauguration. Some people are going to shut it down for Christmas and New Year's. Not a good idea, because there's so much to do. Alicia, anything final? We can expect any new videos in the next couple of days?
Yes, we've got more of a news-style reporting. There's going to be a couple things out on the 0% interest rate and the just the overall economic situation. That should come out tomorrow. And then what should be up tonight are two things. There'll be an American System series on infrastructure as such, and we will have just direct comments from Lynn in the same sort of news-style reporting on just comments he's made throughout his India trip.
Okay, and let me just remind people also what Alicia told us earlier, that there's a new LaRouche PAC interview with Deborah Freeman, Mr. LaRouche's national spokesman, on Soros and how we have to move to eliminate any influence Soros has in any part of the world. So, Michael, Alicia, thank you very much. And Tanu, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
This has been The LaRouche Show, and join us again next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.